This podcast is the first extract from my fourth book, A Series of Memories. It's called A 1950s Boy, Growing Up in Swansea. Early memories are usually deceptive. Do you really recall this moment in your life, all that time ago? Is it more likely to be a second-hand story in which you have assumed the starring role after years of being told about it until now? You're sure you remember it clearly. My earliest memories are an odd mixture of places, events and people. In the book, I have supplemented the stories with some original photos, and despite some attempts at photo editing, the low definition of many of them still retain the haziness and blur from all those years ago. And maybe that is just as it should be, so I make no apologies for this. This series of my memories are not scrupulously organised, although I have attempted some rudimentary sorting into themes, but inevitably there is still some crossover. There is also the question of why write this stuff down. Is it merely nostalgia, understandable having attained the 70 in years, or is it more than that? Clearly it isn't a case of fame, with publishers and newspapers clamouring to get inserts into my life and how my childhood made me the man I am today. For I'm not famous, or even notorious, and known only to my circle of friends and workmates, etc., that I've encountered through my life. If there is one single driver, it may be that I've been looking back to remind myself of how life was different then. And maybe how we struggle sometimes to understand or appreciate aspects of today's world. All things then were not better nor worse, but many certainly were very different. Although I grew up in Wales, I believe that many of the experiences would be common to people of a similar age in other parts of the country, or indeed the world. I probably don't make very much of my Welshness at that time. The language wasn't heard very much in Swansea, but was more prevalent in rural areas and other parts of the Principality, as I was to discover some years later at university in Aberystwyth. Road signs and official documentation had yet to become bilingual. I wasn't aware of any Welsh language television in the 1950s. The Welsh Assembly was some years in the future, and there were no Welsh lessons in my junior school. When I went up to secondary school, Welsh language lessons were limited to one a week in the first year, which the Welsh master used for extensive post-mortems of the school rugby first 15, which was clearly his overriding passion. Latin and French lessons took up more time on the syllabus, without any sports-based digressions. Perhaps the only indication that we were a Welsh grammar school was the singular existence of school rugby football teams, and the total exclusion of soccer from organised games. To the extent that it was not unknown for a master to give a talking to a pupil rumoured to be playing for a soccer team, to seriously reconsider his chosen sport. In conclusion, it was possible to be less conscious of cultural differences, and this may well have been compounded by my mother's English roots, the part of Wales we lived in, and the lack of the language in our lives. At least we still had lava bread and Welsh cakes, though not leeks, due to my dad's onion aversion. Like many others, it took my move after university to live and work in England for me to fully embrace the land of my father's. I found that being Welsh gave one some latitude to think or see things differently, or at least a convenient excuse for doing so. I recall now with some horror and amusement, once sitting on an interview panel discussing a candidate we'd just seen, when the colleague said, "Well, he's very able and bright, but he is Welsh." Somewhat shocked, I interrupted and said, "David, let me just say..." David carried on, "Well, I know I'm stereotyping, but they can be prickly and argumentative." I tried again to interrupt. "David, before you say any more..." But he was on a roll. "Some of them just have a chip on their shoulder and go out of their way to..." I couldn't take any more. I loudly shouted, "David, I am Welsh." Undaunted, he answered, "Good God, are you? It doesn't show." Anyway, we gave Alan the job, and he could be difficult, but not so much with me, and we didn't refer David to the Race Relations Board. Different times. At first, one of my first memories has to be the street party for the coronation of Queen Elizabeth in the summer of 1953. At the time, I would have been around 2¾. The sight of a row of tables in the street, complete with tablecloths, would have been unusual enough to imprint itself on my memory. On the same day, my father told me how he pushed me in my pushchair down the middle of the main road, which was empty of the usual traffic. I'm not sure that I have my own memory of this, but now have an acquired one through repeated tellings of the event. The only memory I have older than this has been taken to view what became our first family house in Tecoke Road, Swansea. My memory of this was on the landing was a large chest of drawers, and on top of this was a big model ship, a fully rigged sailing galleon, in a glass case. Then the even stronger memory was my bitter disappointment when on moving in day I ran upstairs to find that although the chest of drawers was still there, the model ship had gone. I've now come to terms with the disappointment. A later memory, at the age of 3 years and 1 month, was the arrival of my younger brother. I remember that I slept in a double bed with my dad while my mum was in hospital, and each morning was given a small present, gift wrapped by my mother, to compensate for her absence. I can't actually remember her return with my baby brother, but was told that I welcomed him by emptying a handful of my toys into his pram and nearly smothering him. This could be interpreted as an act of generosity, or possibly a disguised assassination attempt. When I was born, it seemed that my parents lived in what was then called rooms, which I believe would today be called a flat, in a house occupied by a landlady who owned the house. This was not an ideal arrangement for a young married couple with a new baby, so we were to move in with my grandparents, that's my mother's parents, and I was told we lived there until I was 2.5 years old. Understandably, because of my age, my memory of this time is limited, although I do have a few. One is of a basket full of tiny kittens in my grandmother's kitchen, although I don't even remember them having a cat. The other is going to town with my mother to go to the market, which wasn't the later covered one, but was a temporary outdoor market. There were tarpaulin canopies like the ones I've recently seen in Mediterranean street markets, but here, no doubt to keep the rain off. On the return up the hill to Heathfield, where my grandparents lived, I remember coming up stone steps with metal railings, one side of which was topped with small coloured globes, like those on mid-century style coat hooks. I wonder if they're still there. Going to school. My first day at school wasn't particularly traumatic, as far as I can remember. It certainly wasn't much of a commute, as we lived next door but one to the school itself, and our neighbour was the school's caretaker. The proximity had benefits later on, when I could play after hours in the playground with friends. The school itself comprised two red brick buildings, single storey for the classrooms and a school hall, but I believe there were some offices on the first floor in a tower, which I think was the head teacher's study. One building was for infants and the second larger one for the junior school pupils. My memory of the first day has been asked if I knew anyone there, and when I replied that I knew a larger dark-haired boy, the son of one of the local shopkeepers that my mum had arranged an unsuccessful play afternoon with some weeks earlier. Although I remember his name and encountered him later in grammar school, I will preserve his identity as I feel it's too late to start a friendship. The details of why the chemistry was wrong are lost to me now, but when I identified him, the teacher asked me if I would like to sit with him. Rather confidently, I said no. So I started my education sitting in a double desk by myself. I like to think it was an early indication of my independent spirit, which may also show that certain characteristics are formed early. I remember that the desks were wooden with a fold-up lid and a cast-iron black metal frame, and that the hard wooden seats were attached to it. The top surface had an inset groove to hold a pen or pencil and a hole for an inkwell, although it was a number of years, I believe, before we were let loose with pen and ink after mastering pencils. I think we had the same style all through infants and junior school, although I would hope that the size was increased in later years to accommodate our young, growing frames. Our proximity to school meant that I could walk to school by myself from a very early age. This was hardly a risk. As I said earlier, we lived next door but one to the school, so front door to the school gate was a walk of 20 yards at most, all in my mum's vision, I guess. This proved to be a disadvantage to me when in the top class of infants at the age of 7 or so, I was summoned to the headmistress's study on the first day of term, somewhere I'd studiously avoided up until then. It was mid-morning break, and the friends I was playing with were as surprised as I was to be called out of the playground by a teacher to go to the head. Once there, I must have had a guilty expression, but was quickly reassured. "It's all right, you're not in trouble." I was asked whether my younger brother had started in school that morning, which he had. "Well, he's escaped, and we hope he's gone home. Please go and check and ask your mother if he can return." At home, I found a very disgruntled four-year-old negotiating with my mother. I caught, "Been to school. Don't like it. Don't like it." I guess the two of us escorted him back under protest. Ironically, he went on to a career in education, so I guess he revised his initial opinion. In the photo, I appear in the back row as the sixth boy from the left side. I do remember the names of some fellow classmates, but I will preserve their dignity. I will say that my friend Jack appears with improbably fair hair as the third boy from the right in the middle row, and despite our better judgment, he has given his permission to embarrass him with this exposure. Jack's house for tea. One of my first memories of socialising outside the family was tea at the house of my first school friend, Jack. We would have been 4 or 5 years old, and details of the first of many visits to his house are sketchy, but one detail that struck me at the time was when we went to watch Children's Hour on television in the front room. The curtains were drawn, possibly to more easily see the faint, small grey picture in early televisions. But it was a new experience for me, as in daylight we watched television at home with the curtains open. I guess the experience prepared me for the later experience of going to the cinema, or the pictures as it was colloquially known. More of the pictures later. Other memories with Jack included envying two impressive presents sent to him by a relative, possibly from abroad. The first was a large form of Swiss Army penknife that came fully equipped with spoon and fork and was much envied by me, along with other members of the local cub pack we belonged to. The even more covetable gift was an actual working space rocket. This was used in the garden and was propelled by mixing water with some magical tablet, probably bicarbonate of soda. Then we stood away and after a countdown pulled a string which removed a cap in the bottom of the bright red rocket between the tail fins. This allowed the rocket to spectacularly shoot high in the air. Unfortunately, living in the suburbs, it inevitably landed in one of the neighbours' gardens, and there was a negotiation process over whose turn it was to either sneak into the garden to retrieve it, or more likely, timidly knock on the neighbour's door to politely ask if we could retrieve it. Experience proved it was more acceptable to ask the neighbour to retrieve our ball rather than admit that we were bombarding them with chemical weaponry, albeit of limited mass destruction capability. Use of the rocket was rationed partly by the limited supply of magic tablets, but also by the limited patience of neighbours to incursions into their gardens. As an adult, I discovered a modern version using water, a plastic drink bottle, and compressed air via a bike pump. And I can heartily recommend it as a way of keeping me and a Labrador retriever entertained. Thankfully, my garden as an adult was large enough that I didn't need embarrassing encounters with neighbours asking for my rocket back. We lost touch after going away to university, but some 20 years later, through our mothers, we re-established contact, so we are now able to regularly reminisce about those days. A few years back, we met in Jack's mum's house, and the memories of those teas and playing in the garden all came flooding back. My tonsils operation. One of my early traumatic memories was going to hospital around the age of 7 for the removal of my tonsils. In the 1950s, this seemed to be a rite of passage for many children, though I haven't heard whether this continues in the 21st century. I presume modern-day children have evolved to naturally destroy their own tonsils by the diligent consumption of massive quantities of crisps and junk food. I must commission some research on this. I can clearly recall being at home packing a small case with pyjamas, dressing gowns, some books and comics, as well as my favourite teddy, Jacko, a yellow glove puppet monkey. The other prized possession put in the case was a recently acquired metal dinky toy, a Gloster Javelin delta-winged RAF model plane. I don't remember the journey, but I do recall the sense of loneliness being left in a ward with a number of other small boys, presumably all there for a similar procedure. I'm not sure about the length of the stay in hospital, but prior to my actual operation, there was time to suffer further trauma when returning to the ward. I discovered two similar-looking boys in the next beds playing with a toy plane, which after checking my case and bedside table, found that my own precious plane was missing. An argument ensued, culminating in my grabbing the plane back after punching the boy in the nose. I emphasise I was not normally given to violence, but the distress of the strange surroundings, compounded by my sense of injustice after the boy had insisted the toy had been loaned to him by his twin brother. Two nurses restored peace and extracted a begrudged confession from the twin that I hadn't hit, though it didn't bode well for a harmonious stay. It transpired that only one of the twins were there for surgery, and the other one was bored and not sure why he needed to be there. Maybe that explained the theft, but as is often the way in closed communities, the demonstration of strength meant that nobody messed with my stuff for the rest of the stay. Fortunately, I have no memory of the surgery, but did become upset when waking with a sore throat after the anaesthetic to discover that I'd missed the ice cream that had been promised after surgery. This disaster was gleefully related by the twin boy in the next bed. I felt too frail and upset to punch him again. When I returned home, I was alarmed when looking at my mouth to find that what I had assumed were my tonsils were still present and could be seen hanging down at the top of my throat. To my later relief, I discovered that this is the uvula and is not recommended for removal. So this ended my first solo encounter with the NHS. It did for some time make any viewing of the popular medical series on TV a less enjoyable experience than it might have been for me. It's interesting what children envy in others, and perhaps it comes from some innate desire for conformity or fitting in, or maybe it's just the baser desire of pure envy and attention seeking. As a child and as an adult, I've been fortunate enough so far to avoid breaking any of my bones, and this is all the more surprising considering the dangerous childhood activities we engaged in, most of which would surely fail any 21st century risk assessment. Maybe because of this, I was always rather jealous when another child turned up at school with a limb or wrist in plaster and would for several days be the centre of attention with classmates autographing or drawing on their plaster cast. The closest I came was spraining an ankle while at one of the bays in Gower on a summer's evening's outing with the scout troop. I like to think that I provided some useful real first aid and emergency practice after the hours we'd spent in the Cubs and Scouts tying knots and practicing first aid treatments. I was carried up the cliff pathway by several of the older Scouts on some kind of improvised stretcher, fashioned from poles and coats, I think. Uncomfortable night with ice packs on the tender ankle and a visit to the local pharmacist who operated an informal medical triage system. It avoided all those hours hanging about in the doctor's waiting room catching germs from all the sick people there. At least that seemed to be my mum's theory. It was announced that I had a mild sprain and could go to school the next day wearing a modest elastic bandage that nobody could autograph. The other thing we lived in dread of was appendicitis, which the handful of children who'd experienced an appendectomy were describing gruesome details, including showing scars where they'd been cut open. Any rational examination of this would have concluded that the patient would be out cold and have little recollection of the treatment. Apparently one youngster had kept a piece of gauze bandage containing their 7 stitches in black cotton and would proudly show this to everyone for the following 12 months. In any event, my only hospital visit for the removal of my tonsils had already done enough to deter any inclination for further visits to hospital. Dressing up. It was a custom in schools in Wales that on St David's Day, children in the infants' classes would come to school dressed in traditional costumes. This was easier for the girls, with wool shawls and tall black hats, but I have a memory that around the age of 6, the favoured dress code for boys was as knights in armour. In those days, there wasn't the availability of cheap supermarket costumes. Well, there weren't any supermarkets. It was creative homemade costumes all the way. The cardboard helmet and wooden shield were within my parents' DIY capabilities, but they really excelled themselves with a chainmail jerkin, which they created out of a sack with armholes and neck holes cut out, and the whole ensemble painted with what must have been silver aluminium paint. I was very taken with it and set off the costume with a grey balaclava, elastic snake belt, Wellington boots and brandishing a plastic sword. Unfortunately, the lateness of preparations combined with the thickness of the paint on the sackcloth resulted in a certain sticky tackiness, which no doubt left its mark in school on chairs and elsewhere. I believe I was asked to go home to change at lunchtime. Fancy dress is often considered to be part of Sunday school or cub group parties, and as I said earlier, these usually needed to be fashioned from do-it-yourself materials. I was fortunate in having some relatives who lived abroad, so there was more of a supply of exotic materials to choose from. Now, in more culturally enlightened days, some of this seems insensitive, but the 1950s in Wales were limited in their diversity, and racial stereotypes are harvested from TV programmes, books and films. The perennial favourite was cowboy costumes, given that any boy and some girls were already owners of cowboy costumes and eager to brandish toy guns, often equipped with loud percussion caps, given any opportunity. I also remember my mum creating a Davy Crockett hat out of some fur offcuts so it had the requisite tail hanging down the back. I don't think it was as popular with me as the more traditional cowboy hats, as it was rather hot to wear, but it proved useful to stop the family cat sleeping on my bed, as when placed there he would leave the room quickly, thinking a feline rival had already taken up residence. The supply of a strange hat from Singapore, twinged with a silk dressing gown and charcoal moustache and eyeliner, plus a wool pigtail, provided a Fu Manchu costume similar to that of Tiger Lily's dad in the Rupert books. An even more exotic get-up was seen in my African drummer boy outfit. One of my mother's older brothers was a captain in an African rifle regiment in what was then called East Africa. Souvenirs were either posted or brought home during leave periods. I remember a rather nonplussed postman delivering to us a whole coconut in its large, hard outside husk with our address painted on it in yellow paint. Also, my dad tried several times to split it in the garden with a hatchet to extract the actual coconut. Of the more use for fancy dress purposes was an African talking drum, which changed tone when the strings down the edge between the two ends were squeezed or relaxed under the arm while being hit with a strong bent drumstick which had been sent with it. Probably very annoying in the hands of any infant schoolchild. I also believe, in looking at the photo, that the bottom half of the outfit comprised of pieces of animal hide, also posted from Africa, and hopefully not part of some endangered species. Some of, if not all of those, would be unacceptable today, but those were different times.